it please the court, counsel. Mark Bendinelli, registration 28425. We just knocked out a little bit of what I have prepared by way of background and history. So I won't get into it. It was a car, deeply, but it was a car accident and for which the plaintiff received $140,000 worth of evidence to the trial court relative to her medical bills. The four main points that I want to try to cover this morning is that at the conclusion of the trial court instructed the jury that following the treatment recommendations of the health care providers qualified for a failure to mitigate damages instruction. The second point would be it's a bill versus paid issue. At the time that this case went to trial, it was a year after the Court of Appeals came out with Walmart v. Crossgrove. So this case went to trial in 2011, but in 2010, the Court of Appeals came out with Walmart v. Crossgrove. Of course, that was later affirmed by the Colorado Supreme Court. And there was evidence of, despite the existence of Crossgrove at that time, there was evidence of collateral source allowed into evidence during the trial, a lot of it. A subpoint of that is whether liens, when Michelle Bannon, at some time during the course of her treatments, for a good portion of it, she had health insurance. And for a period of time, she was treated on a lien. And so a subpoint of collateral source is whether a lien is also a collateral source.
Failed to respond to the motion in limine in the trial court, though. Didn't the trial court deem that confessed?
I don't believe that to be correct. And we timely preserved at the trial court when there was a discussion of liens anyway. So I didn't do the motions practice leading up to this trial, but I don't believe that to be the case, or else I don't think we would have preserved. Potentially. The third point is that there was a motion in limine regarding the Michelle Bannon had a long ago domestic violence incident. And so we filed a motion in limine to keep out that mention of that domestic violence. The court issued an order saying that there shall not be any mention of domestic violence. And yet the defense examiner Dr. Brian Lambden brought it up in his testimony. Dr. Lambden, and the fourth and final point is Dr. Lambden also testified about the minimum forces that were required to produce injury, despite him not being qualified to do so. I'm going to take these points in reverse chronological order. I'm going to start with the failure to mitigate instruction, even though that happened at the end of the trial, because that is the only appealable issue that we preserve that that requires a de novo review. And I'm going to have to read some case law here. But so jury instructions are de novo review to assure accurate statements of the law, and that's Fishman v. Knotts. Can I forego the cites?
Yes.
Okay. The trial court commits reversible error in giving any instruction if it misleads the jury in any way. If so, the judgment must be overturned. It is error if the instruction is prejudicial in any way, and it must be overturned. And that's Brown v. Walmart. A failure to mitigate has always been a failure to do something, an omission. Law school, they teach you about when the storm comes through and it breaks the pane glass window and the water's coming in, you have to move your television, right? So it's a failure to act. In the absence of which, increases the defendant's damages. Failure to mitigate, the trial court's position on this failure to mitigate instruction is that because she followed the treatment recommendations of her physicians, that that qualified for failure to mitigate instruction. This is a big, I think, in my humble opinion, this is a big issue in Colorado, this this case right here, because if this is not overturned, any time a healthcare provider makes recommendations, treatment recommendations, and you follow those treatment recommendations, then you're going to be subject to a failure to mitigate instruction. And the case law is clear. It talks about the law in Colorado is that a plaintiff is required to submit to reasonable medical treatment and follow the advice of the physician. Of course, the case, the example in the case law is that if someone has a shoulder surgery and they don't go to physical therapy, and then they end up with a frozen shoulder or adhesive capsulitis requiring additional treatment, then that's a failure to mitigate, increasing the damages. That doesn't mean the plaintiff must submit to all medical treatment. In Hilliard v. Western Fasteners, cited in the Oklahoma case, Jones v. Epler, plaintiff's obligation to seek a cure for his injuries does not require him to submit to a surgery that involves substantial risk or harm.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Bendinelli, if I may, please. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that we were to agree with you that this was an erroneous instruction. Would you explain to me, please, why it is sufficiently prejudicial to justify reversing the judgment in this case?
Well, because this, what happened here was identical to the Crossgrove case. In Crossgrove, and you're making me jump ahead, but that's fine. In Crossgrove, there was approximately $250,000 worth of medical bills. Okay? And in that case, because they mentioned insurance and write-offs and charge-offs, the jury ended up finding approximately $50,000 in damages. And I did the math, that's approximately 20% of the claimed medical specials in Crossgrove. In our case, there was approximately $140,000 worth of medical bills. And I'm telling you, from opening statement to closing argument, charge-offs, health insurance, no health insurance, liens, write-offs, this kind of amounts that the providers had to accept based on the contract with their with the insurer. It was all through this trial. And ironically, that's what happened in Crossgrove. And in this case, the jury awarded approximately $30,000 out of $140,000, almost it's 20% of the claimed medical specials. It's exactly what happened in Crossgrove. And let me jump back here.
How do we know, Mr. Bendinelli, that the jury didn't look at this and say these expenses, or a major portion of them, were not reasonable or necessary?
Well, I'm going to get to that right now. In Klein v. State Farm, this honorable court, Colorado Court of Appeals, stated that whether a plaintiff's treatment and expenses are reasonable and necessary and related, in the old days when we had PIP, we used to call RN and R, reasonable, necessary, related, is always a question for the jury. But never before, and the defendant acquiesced in their brief, there's no case law on this. Never before has the questioning of the reasonable and necessary and relatedness of the medical care ever gone hand in hand. Never with a mitigation instruction. It's never happened. Here, the defendant did not seek the instruction because the plaintiff failed to submit the treatment recommendations, but rather because the plaintiff followed through with the treatment recommendations of the healthcare provider. She had facet injuries, and it required intra-articular facet injections, a medial branch blockade, radio frequency neurolysis, you know, complicated procedures. And the appellee is asking the court to rewrite the law on mitigation, basically. It essentially changed the law to say that after a traumatic injury if the plaintiff follows the healthcare provider's recommendation, and for instance, goes to 12 sessions of physical therapy, and if the defense doctor then says, well, I don't think physical therapy was necessary, then they get a mitigation instruction based on the appellee's argument. And so should the court adopt that, it would tempt all injured parties. The other thing is, this is not something that Michelle Banning did. Any mitigation has to be a failure on the part of the plaintiff. She didn't fail to do anything. She followed the healthcare provider recommendations by undergoing these surgeries or procedures that are required. You're required to go to an ambulatory surgery center to get them. So what the appellee wants to argue is that if you follow recommendations for physical therapy, they could be subject to a failure to mitigate instruction. If you don't follow the instruction, I mean the recommendations of the healthcare provider, then you're subject to a failure to mitigate instruction. And it's confusing and it misleads the jury. So to have a position that this diametrically opposed conduct, no matter what, will result in a failure to mitigate instruction is clearly misleading to a jury and not a correct application of the law. So we believe that was clearly in error. Did I go? I'll reserve 3 minutes and got 3 minutes left. Oh, my goodness. Okay, 3 minutes, 30 seconds. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kimberly Shutt, registration number 25947, appearing here on behalf of Mr. Prester, who was the defendant in the personal injury action below. We are also the cross-appellant here with regard to a very limited procedural issue which occurred post-trial, and I will address that issue briefly later in my argument. I'd like to first address the issues that have been raised by Ms. Banning. And there are several, but I would submit to you that none of them are actual errors on the part of the trial court. Certainly not the type of prejudicial error that would require reversing the jury's verdict here. Many of the issues were either injected into the case by the plaintiff herself or waived by a failure to respond to a motion in limine or to otherwise timely object during the course of trial. Before I delve into each one of those issues individually, I'd like the court to take a look at the big picture here. This was an automobile accident that occurred at a very low speed. The photographic evidence and testimony from the witnesses was that there was very minimal damage to the vehicles. The issue of the nature and extent of Ms. Banning's injuries was very much disputed at trial, particularly the $120,000 in injections that she received from Dr. Centeno. What happened during the course of the trial is exactly what we endeavor to have happen in any civil jury trial, particularly one that arises in this particular context. Both parties had experts come in to testify and give opinions as to the nature of her injuries and whether or not the medical expenses were reasonable and necessary. There was some evidence that came in regarding health insurance. I believe the extent of that has been overstated. If you review the record, it's actually not that extensive. Some of that, though, was injected into the case by the plaintiff herself. But in any event, the trial court recognized, in light of Crossgrove and some of those other cases that were pending at the time, that there may be a danger of some confusion. And she specifically gave an instruction to the jury telling them to disregard that evidence and to not include it in their determination as to what was reasonable and necessary. The court and counsel then worked together to put together a packet of instructions which included the mitigation instruction. That was approved by both counsel going into the time of closing arguments and the reading of instructions to the jury. The jury then had the opportunity to weigh the credibility of the various witnesses and come to a verdict which it believed to be fair and reasonable. That is what we endeavor to have happen in any civil jury case.
Chuck, yes. can I ask you, I'd like to discuss the failure to mitigate issue.
Yes.
Why isn't it true that you got essentially two bites of the apple in the reasonable and necessary instruction and in the failure to mitigate instruction?
I think that if you look at the case law regarding what constitutes a failure to mitigate, it's not just a failure to act. It's whether or not the plaintiff has acted reasonably so as to avoid or minimize damages. In this particular case, there was evidence not only that she failed to follow her doctor's recommendations and engage in physical therapy, failed to stop smoking, things of that nature. There was also evidence that she continued going to Dr. Centeno for these very expensive injections, even though by her own reports, they were not giving her significant relief from the pain that she was reporting.
Well, there was some evidence, though, that she testified, I think, that the injection did give her some relief.
Defense counsel reviewed the injections in the course of the history of those injections during Dr. Lambden's testimony, and there was testimony that the reports that she gave was well below the placebo response in a number of instances. I think there was sufficient evidence, given the general law regarding mitigation of damages, for the trial judge and her discretion to submit that instruction to the jury, and that accurately stated the defense response. I think you have to look at the jury instructions as a whole. And it was the defendant's theory that these expenses were not reasonable and necessary, and that she acted unreasonably in continuing to rack up these treatment expenses when...
But why isn't that covered in the reasonable and necessary instruction as opposed to the failure to mitigate? I'm not hearing why you didn't get two bites of the apple here. It seems like you did.
Well, it may be considered two bites of the apple, but we can argue different theories as to why there was mitigation of why there was a failure to mitigate her damages. I don't know that there's any case law which says that we can't have more than one theory as to how that occurred. I also don't know how in the end that prejudiced Ms. Banning. It was the instructions were entirely consistent with one another that these expenses were not reasonable or necessary, and that they constituted a failure on her part to minimize or avoid damages.
Is there any evidence that she was told specifically that she could find the same treatment elsewhere for less?
I don't believe there was any specific evidence of her being told that, but I think that to the extent that they're arguing that all she was doing was following her doctor's advice, that was an argument to be made in trial in rebuttal to our defense that she had failed to mitigate her damages. For them to get up and say to the jury, it's not mitigation of damages because she was just simply following her doctor's advice. And I don't believe that that argument was ever made. Second of all...
Pardon me, Ms. Schutt.
Yes.
Pardon me for interrupting, but while we're on this subject...
Mm-hmm.
Would you please respond to Mr. Bendinelli's argument that if you allow this, you are basically going to inject into every case in which a plaintiff has some treatment that is not ultimately successful, that opens the door for that being part of a failure to mitigate?
I don't think that opens the door in every case, because what has to happen is, in any case where an instruction is given, the trial judge has to look at whether or not there's evidence to support that. I think this is a very case-specific situation where there was $120,000 worth of medical expenses being claimed for these injections, which the defense contended it was unreasonable for her to continue pursuing. The judge acted within her discretion in this particular case to allow that instruction. I don't think it sets it up as to be precedent to follow in each and every case regarding that. I think you can make it tied to this particular case.
Are you aware of any case law that supports your assertion, failure to mitigate?
The part of the instruction regarding her failure to mitigate due to not following her doctor's advice, not by continuing to smoke and conservative therapy, that's fully supported.
I have no problem with that. What about this continuing to undergo expensive treatment?
There is no Colorado case which specifically says that it's appropriate to give an instruction. There's, or saying that it's not appropriate. There's just the general law in Colorado, the Fair, the Red Lion Inn case that talks about what is failure, mitigation of damages, talking about it, failing to minimize or avoid damages which could have otherwise been avoided. And I think that this argument fairly falls into that. I think it's also important to point out that I'm not sure this issue is even properly before the court. Mr. Bendinelli, on behalf of the plaintiff, approved this particular instruction twice before the instructions were handed to the jury and the judge started reviewing them. In the afternoon instruction conference that occurred the day before trial ended, this instruction was specifically discussed and no objection was made. The next morning, prior to the jury being given the instructions as the judge was finalizing them, she specifically asked, Mr. Bendinelli, have you reviewed the finalized packet? He said yes and indicated he had no objections. It wasn't until these instructions had been handed to the jury and the judge was reviewing them that he first voiced some objection. I would submit that it was waived at that point. With regard to the issue of the references to health insurance, again, the judge gave a curative instruction on that. And the jury is presumed as a matter of law to have followed it. I think a review of the record shows that it was not so extensive as to have caused any prejudice. They've not demonstrated any prejudice, which would have occurred as a result of the jury hearing that evidence, much of which came in because of questions that Ms. Manning's own counsel asked of her witnesses, and specifically stated in his closing argument, despite the fact that he knew this curative instruction was being given. With regard to the issue of cross-examination of the doctors regarding the liens, it was indeed confessed by the plaintiff. There was a specific motion in limine that was filed prior to trial. The court's minute order from the hearing on those motions in limine, which is found at page 710 in the record, specifically indicates that that motion in limine was confessed. In the minute order that came out following the trial, the judge again reiterates that that issue was confessed at page 7.
Excuse me, I'm confused here. Okay. I thought that it was the lien injury issue that was confessed.
It was. I'm sorry. That's what I'm referring to.
Okay. You mentioned the cross-examination of the doctor, so I was confused.
Well, and that's how that evidence came in. The defense counsel specifically asked the doctors regarding the fact that they were treating the plaintiff on a lien and therefore had a financial stake in any outcome of that case, that they had agreed not to charge the plaintiff for any. She didn't pay anything out of pocket to those doctors in exchange for them having the right to get paid out of her verdict at trial. And so that was the limited issue to which the trial judge allowed that evidence to come in. And again, because the jury had been given a curative instruction saying you can't take into account any write-offs, set-offs, discounts, anything like that, there's no prejudice could have occurred here. It was proper under the liberal standards which are allowed for cross-examination as to issues of bias for the judge to have allowed it. And again, it was waived by the plaintiff. I'd like to just, if I have time, I'll come back to the issue of the domestic abuse testimony from Dr. Landon. I'd like to just briefly address the issue that we've raised on appeal here regarding the offsetting judgments. This was a case where, following the trial, Judge Glowinski retired, a new judge came in to deal with post-trial motions. We filed a motion asking the judge to offset the cost judgment, which had been entered in favor of Mr. Prester, against the overall judgment on the merits that had been granted to the plaintiff. And the new judge entered an order which just simply wrote denied on our motion without going into any analysis. Pursuant to the cases that we've cited in our brief, particularly Husband and Steiner and Theos, they make clear that the proper procedure in Colorado, when you have two opposing parties, particularly in one lawsuit, who are each receiving a judgment, that the proper procedure is to offset the lower judgment from the other one, leaving one net judgment. And the trial court refused to do that here. Ms. Banning has made some suggestion in her response brief that offsetting judgments was improper here because of an attorney lien issue. Though there are some cases that talk about that, there is absolutely no evidence in the record here that any lien existed or that the proper statutory procedures were employed to perfect that lien prior to us making the request for the offsetting judgment. And so if there was any error at all in these proceedings here, we submit that it was simply that one procedural error post-trial. With regard to the testimony that Dr. Lambden gave regarding Ms. Banning's history of domestic abuse, the trial judge's order was not, as Mr. Bendinelli stated, that the witnesses could not talk about this at all. In fact, her own doctors had, Ms. Dr. Gappa had referred to her history of domestic abuse in his treatment notes and indicating that some underlying psychological issues might be affecting her ability to recover. It was a relevant issue, as recognized by the trial court. She allowed Dr. Lambden to refer simply to the fact that there was this history of abuse and that he had noted it in Dr. Gappa's records, but not go into any details. And that's exactly what he did. His testimony simply made reference to it in talking about the psychological issues that may have been underlying her physical injuries and stayed within the confines of the court order. Again, there is nothing about that very limited testimony which would require the court to reverse the verdict here. The standards of review are that a jury's verdict is entitled to great deference and not to be overturned unless there's some evidence of passion or prejudice or so inadequate as to shock the conscience, and we simply don't have that here. The jury did exactly what it was asked to do. It assessed the credibility of the various parties. It's verdict is well supported by the record and consistent with what defense counsel argued in her closing argument would be a reasonable amount for damages, and there's no evidence of any prejudice based on the instructions or any of the evidence that came in that would cause the need to reverse that decision. Thank you.
I'm just going to briefly address the domestic violence issue. Dr. Gappa, who was on the stand, he had in his notes that they were having some family issues. On cross-examination, they asked him what that was, and he said, well, the husband lost his job, they only had one car. I'm not sure what that was about. That was Dr. Gappa's testimony, and that was what is being proffered, is that we opened the door to allow the domestic violence incident to come in. Getting back to the collateral source issue, the holding at Crossgrove states, evidence is an amount paid by health insurers and amounts discounted, paren, or written off, close paren, from the bill amount is inadmissible. There's another case, Echo v. New York Central Railroad, that says when evidence of a collateral source comes into trial, we can presume that it's prejudice. Anything that there's prejudice created, anything that a jury can use to adjust or reduce damages is presumed prejudice on its face. It's prima facie showing. The other thing is that the instruction that the judge gave stated as follows. What happened here is the judge created the unintended consequence of even further putting this in the jury's face, if you'll excuse the expression. Here's the jury instruction. The jury must determine what plaintiff's reasonable and necessary medical and hospital expenses were. The jury shall disregard any evidence of set-offs, write-offs, discharges, co-pays, and insurance payments. This testimony evidence shall not be considered by the jury. And so they're back there knowing that this was charged off, that was charged off, and getting back. So I believe that the curative instruction failed to correct any misleading of the jury. In fact, it further highlighted that, and again, 20% of the medical specials in Cross Grove were paid. In this case, 20% of the medical specials were paid by a jury because the jury was tainted and this curative instruction is ineffective. With respect to the failure to mitigate, there were charges from hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers that were characterized by Dr. Landon, who does not do, he admitted he's never done a facet injection, he's never done intra-articular, the medial branch block or this radio frequency procedure. He's not qualified, he's not board certified, yet he said that Dr. Centeno's treatment was expensive and unnecessary. And so it's not only this one particular healthcare provider, it's also the facility charge, the anesthesiologist, and I just want to stress again that should the Appellee's argument be upheld, then there's going to be there's a no-win situation for any injured party anywhere. It doesn't matter what they do; they're going to be subject to a failure to mitigate instruction. And I'm out of time. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.